Coming to you from the salon of an ancient king, it's The Liberal Arts.
A podcast about post-grad life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please someone pay us.
So, guys, you guys know that I love Star Trek, but did you know...
We know this.
You know this, yes. Did you know that a very important piece of technology from Star Trek has recently made its way into real life?
Is it communicators? Because I feel like we've had those for a while.
Is it a tricorder? Please say yes.
Ooh, no, please say it's the thing that, like, prints food. Like, just gets you, like, tea, Earl Grey, hot. I want that.
You can get that without a replicator.
Explain more.
It is a piece of equipment that is similar to Geordi LaForge's vision visor. Star Trek Enterprise.
Okay.
It's not Star Trek Enterprise, it's Star Trek Next Gen.
Yes, exactly.
It's Enterprise, because they're on the Enterprise. And it's Enterprise that matters.
That's not how Star Trek works.
It's a different series.
It's Next
different
Gen.
Captain. There's no Geordi LaForge in Enterprise.
Yeah.
Fine.
This matters.
This matters. We're gonna get angry emails.
It's Star Trek Next Gen.
Now tell me about this visor. Why do you know this?
Okay, why do I know this? Because it popped up on my Facebook feed as an article, and it was like, Star Trek's visor comes to life, and it sounded ridiculous, but it is a pair of glasses that helps people...
We know you are a connoisseur of clickbait.
It's really bad. Most of it is puppies, but every once in a while I learn something mildly useful. So I was reading the article, and there's a company who has this set of glasses for people with low vision or fading, degenerating vision. And what it does is you put them on your eyes, and it kind of takes a video and then magnifies it on the in-glass screen so that you can see in full color.
Wow.
Oh.
Whereas people couldn't see before.
Like, if you were blind, just couldn't see anything, it wouldn't help? But if just can see very poorly, it would?
Yeah, I think the impression I got is like, for people whose vision is degenerating, or they're, like, legally blind or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, about 90% of people who are legally blind are not completely blind, so.
This is true.
So it takes the video that it makes and magnifies it within the visor so that your eyes can see it.
It's really clever.
That's amazing.
I've actually heard of people doing that before. I had someone... We were once talking about what to do when you lose your glasses or you lose a contact or something. And I saw a friend of mine who had lost a contact took out their phone and took a picture of something far away and, like, zoomed in with their phone and then brought the phone really close to their face and, like, read a sign or something.
Yeah, that's basically
that's a good idea.
Yeah.
What it does. But it's really cool. I was on YouTube last night watching videos of people get this eye machine for the first time and be able to see people for the first time in their life, and it was really fun.
That's awesome.
But
that is... Oh my gosh, that's so cool.
So, yes, Star Trek has made inroads into real life in more than one area, because did you also know that on Star Trek Voyager, they once had a very special guest?
Oh, who's that? Wait. It's gonna be...
Are you talking about Mae Jameson? Because she was on Next Gen.
No.
Yeah, who?
Oh, I love her.
King Abdullah of Jordan.
What?
Whoa.
Yes. Apparently King Abdullah is a Trekkie. And
oh, I love it.
Back when he was still Prince Abdullah in 1996, he got himself a non-speaking, one-scene role on an episode of Star Trek
That's
Voyager.
Wonderful.
And
Voyager is next on the rewatch, so I'm very excited to see Prince Abdullah. No, King Abdullah.
Okay, so those are my fun facts for the day. Science, did you have anything you would like to tell us in our colloquium today?
I did. Today's colloquium is about a man named Benjamin Rush.
Whoa.
Is he like Jeffrey Rush's friend?
Yes. They're brothers.
No, what?
Okay, so Benjamin Rush he's actually known for a lot of things. He's probably not commonly known. The best thing that he's probably known for is as a signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Other people signed that. No, I'm just kidding.
Nope, it was just other John than Hancock. Who, like, just Hancock.
Just only Hancock. Him. Hancock is the only person who signed it. Everyone knows this.
But he did a whole lot of things. He's a really interesting guy, and so I'm going to tell you all about him. He was born January 4th, 1746, in Philadelphia County, which at the time was 14 miles outside of Philadelphia. It's not anymore, because Philadelphia is large. Shocking. He was the fourth of seven children.
Wow.
Which is kind of impressive, because when he was 5 years old, his father died. So, like... Oh, wow. Cranking out those children for you to kick it.
Dang.
Yeah.
Hello.
That's a lot of kids in 5 years.
Yes, it is. So he was the very middle of seven children. His father died when he was five, which meant that his mom was left to raise seven children on her own. Dang. She actually ran a grocery store. She did a great job. Like, his brothers and sisters all went on to interesting and illustrious careers as well.
They all lived?
I mean, yes.
Wow, sorry, awesome. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, well, okay, I think he had more siblings than that died. I could be wrong about that. Yeah, that's a good question. I'll look into that. So when he was 8 years old, his mom was like, I can barely feed you and your brother anymore, and anyway, you should get an education, so I'm going to send you off to my brother, whose name was Samuel Finley. Samuel Finley is best known for... helping to found West Nottingham Academy, which is a disputed title, but a title nonetheless, the oldest boarding school in the United States.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, still running.
Convenient to go with our family member then.
Yeah, exactly. He's also later a president of Princeton College. So Samuel Finley educated Benjamin and his brother. He actually is one of the ones who encouraged Benjamin to go to medical school to be a doctor. So he also, like, he very much spurred on these boys in their education. When Benjamin was 14, he graduated from the College of New Jersey with a Bachelor's of Arts.
Nice.
When he was 14.
Oh, wow.
And, like, okay. They went to college younger then. I'm talking 16, 17, but, like, when you're 14, you got a degree. Like, what have you been doing lately?
Wow.
Talk about your post-grad life. Hello, I'm 15 years old and just noticed girls exist and I have a degree.
When you say Bachelor of Arts, though, I thought you said medical. It wasn't, like, a science degree?
Well, this was his first degree when he was 14.
Oh, his first
one. He became a doctor later.
Oh, okay. What was his degree in? Just, like, art?
The sources I looked at did not specify.
Oh, interesting.
I'm thinking it's just kind of a general studies degree.
Right.
Like, the kind of thing you get when you might be a clergyman or a lawyer.
Or you're 15.
Or you're 15. So, after that, he was apprenticed to a doctor in Philadelphia for something like 8 years, which is about a good long time for an apprenticeship. Mm. And Samuel Finley is like, hey, Benjamin, you should go to Scotland and get your further education, get your medical degree.
Cool.
So, yeah, he studied medicine at the University of Edinburgh.
I applied there. They let me in. I actually was going to go there until I got accepted to Oxford. That's a cool place.
Yeah, he liked it, apparently. Yeah, he studied, that's where he got his medical degree and became Benjamin Rush Medical Doctor. He also traveled Europe while he was there, and he became fluent in four languages.
Oof, jeez.
As you do.
Just while he was getting a degree?
Just, yeah, you know.
Which four?
Okay, obviously English.
French.
Also Spanish, Italian, and French. After that, he came back to Philadelphia and became a professor of chemistry at the College of Philadelphia. You see why I like him. He also wrote the first American textbook on chemistry in 1770, which was entitled A Syllabus of a Course of Lectures on Chemistry.
He knows four languages, and that's the best thing he can think of. I'm sorry.
You make a fair point.
Dang.
No, you're right. So yeah, he was a really prolific writer all throughout his life, in addition to other textbooks and a lot of medical articles. He also wrote a bunch of patriotic essays. And this is where his story kind of coincides with the story that we know about the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. He is quoted as saying in one of his essays, "Patriotism is as much a virtue as justice and is as necessary for the support of societies as natural affection is for the support of families." Oh, I know, I heard you.
No.
I heard your ethics break.
No, wrong. Listen,
I agree with you. I do. I don't agree with Benjamin Rush in this area. Okay, I just, cool. I thought it was
as long
a
as
quote.
as long as we are of one accord.
Well, yeah, he also said, okay, you want me to read another quote that we may or may not actually agree with? "It would seem from this fact that man is naturally a wild animal, and that when taken from the woods, he is never happy in his natural state till he returns to them again."
Wow. Thank you. He's been reading.
He just really wanted to live in the woods.
Says the professor of
chemistry. Why doesn't he just go off and be, you know, like Henry David Thoreau or something? Like, go to Walden Pond and leave everyone else alone.
He was too busy healing people.
Wait, hold on. Mercury. He wants people to go back to the woods, but he also wants them to be patriotic and nationalistic. That does not work.
These are my woods. Mine?
No, but patriotic, it's not just mine, it's ours.
Very patriotic.
Like, there are Appalachians other people necessarily woods. Involved.
Listen, we'll talk about the depths of Benjamin Rush's hypocrisy later.
I don't like this guy. Hannah, make me like him.
I like him because he's interesting, not necessarily because he's a good person.
Okay, that's a good point.
You're going to like him even less in a little bit. Ready?
Oh, God.
So he joined the Sons of Liberty in the 1770s and was really involved in their actions during the lead up to the American Revolution.
AKA, the Boston Tea Party?
Oh, yeah. Nobody knows who exactly was at the Boston Tea Party.
Right.
Also, he was based in Philadelphia, so he may not have been there. He also, he knew Thomas Paine personally, and he helped edit and then paid for some of the publishing costs of Common Sense.
Oh, fun.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. He was friends with basically every prominent member of the American Revolution that you could name.
Alexander Hamilton!
I mean, maybe not I didn't see any coinciding there.
Mm.
But he probably met him. Because he met all of them.
George Washington!
Sorry. Oh, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Oh, boy. Yay!
He also often wrote letters to Patrick Henry. Henry of... I do, too. He's the one who's most famous for saying, "Give me liberty or give me death."
All right.
Famous patriotic orator.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
Fun fact, I memorized that entire speech in middle school to audition for a play. The play was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
That's interesting.
I love it.
Did you get the part?
Yeah.
No, I did not. I didn't even get a
callback. What part were you auditioning for? Like Susan?
Any of them, really.
Edmund. Okay. Give me liberty. Any of the statues in the witch's castle.
All of the statues in the witch's castle.
All at once. Okay, where were we?
We were talking about Dr. Rush and Patrick Henry.
Right.
Yes.
Dr. Rush was bros with all kinds of people. Although notably, he did have some dispute with everyone's favorite history crush, George Washington.
No. I was gonna say Alexander Hamilton again. Wait, no. So he and Washington weren't bros?
Alright, let me tell you something.
Fight!
You've been to way too many football matches, Rissa.
So in 1776, Dr. Rush was promoted to be the Surgeon General of the Continental Army. Even though he did not get along with the Continental Congress's medical committee. By the way, he was elected to the Continental Congress. That's why he signed the Declaration. Right. His father-in-law did, too. He married the man's daughter afterwards.
Why didn't this man get along with the general?
Well, he wrote to Patrick Henry. Okay, so he wrote to Patrick Henry. He's like, "Hey, Patrick, would you do me a favor?" I have some anonymous critique I'd like you to give to George Washington.
Oh, no.
And if you could read it out to him so that he doesn't recognize my handwriting, I just want you to tell him that his counselors are weak and his army is a mess. Could you tell him that for me? Would you do that?
When was this? Like, at what point in Washington's career did this occur?
This was 76.
Okay. I just wondered if this was, like, at the I shoot back, we have resorted to eating our horses stage of the war. Or not?
I don't remember when Valley Forge was.
Valley Forge was 77.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was probably around that time. He also complained about how the medical staff was severely undersupplied. And he set, like, tattled on his fellow doctors on the medical committee, saying things like, ugh, they give wine to dying people. What a waste.
Wow. I do not like this guy.
Okay, Emma. So... Wait for it.
So this is Rush who's writing this letter, correct?
Yeah, he's writing this letter. Could you tell Washington that his counselors suck and his army's a mess? Please, Patrick, would you do that for me? And Patrick Henry's like, sure, I've got you. But did he read the letter aloud to George Washington? No. He put it in George Washington's hand, and George Washington read it, and he's like, is this Benjamin Rush's handwriting?
No.
And it totally was.
And this is why we really like Patrick Henry, because Patrick Henry was not about to be petty. He was just going like, sure, I'll pass it on. You can deal with the consequences. I'm not getting in the middle of that.
Later on, our dear Benjamin, he took back his comments. He apologized for them. In the book 1776, the author quotes Benjamin Rush is saying, at some point, it wasn't clear on when, that, yeah, he said that Washington has so much martial dignity in his deportment that you would distinguish him to be a general and a soldier from among 10,000 people. There is not a king in Europe that would not look like a valet de chambre by his side.
Wow.
Basically, he said, this man is so, so classy. He makes all of the kings of Europe looked like bathroom attendants.
He's really trying to make up for that letter, isn't he?
Yeah, really. So he did a lot of things while he was Surgeon General of the Continental Army. He wrote something called Directions to Preserving the Health of Soldiers. It was a military order, like, to people, like, preventative medicine kind of thing. But because a lot of his orders were just good sense, it ended up being the norm and well accepted up until like 1908.
Wow!
Like a standard for treating your soldiers.
What kind of stuff?
Things like if you're sick, don't go fight.
Wow! Wow!
He also did things like underrepresent how many people died from sickness. And he didn't visit all of the hospitals he was supposed to go to as the Surgeon General. And, yeah, as I said, he tattled on the other doctors. So what with one thing and another, he resigned in 1778. He is, however, immortalized in a famous painting. A famous painting by John Trumbull. I know you've seen this painting.
Oh.
It's called The Death of General Mercer at the Battle of Princeton, January 3rd. There's a lot of redcoats stabbing people and horses, and George Washington rides in heroically in the background. Also in the background is our boy Benjamin Rush, riding in with Washington, saving the day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was there at the Battle of Princeton, and John Trumbull put him in the painting.
Pause 1 second. Is he on the horse behind Washington?
I don't think so. I think he's meant to be on a horse that is... beside Washington's horse.
Okay, that perspective is awful, because it looks like he's like, riding...
Yeah, he's just riding it behind Washington.
I got you, George!
No one's gonna shoot you with your Surgeon General on the back of your horse. Okay, so after he resigned, he went back to teaching. He also went back to founding colleges of higher learning. He founded Dickinson College and Franklin College, which are both in the Philadelphia, Lancaster area, as well as, what is it called? The Young Ladies Academy of Philadelphia, which was the first Philadelphia Institute for Higher Learning for women.
Oh, wow.
Very nice.
Yeah. In 1784, he became a surgeon, like a head surgeon at Pennsylvania Hospital. And that's what he did for the rest of his life. He gave up teaching at that point to be a surgeon. Okay, so so far he's been a very interesting background character in the Revolution, and we know this. But he's most famous for the yellow fever outbreak of 1793.
You make it sound like he started this yellow fever outbreak. I'm assuming he did not.
It's all his fault.
So what did he do? Did he stop it?
We'll get into that. So
that's a no.
He tried.
Let's talk about it. So it started in the spring of 1793, and as a surgeon at the Pennsylvania Hospital, he started noticing people dying of yellow fever, but they weren't the usual people dying of yellow fever. So, like, yellow fever is a virus, a very bad virus. It's carried by mosquitoes. But usually it's only so bad that it kills older people and very young children. So, like, a bad flu.
Okay.
However, some of the first people to die from this yellow fever outbreak were teenagers and grown men. And he immediately saw that and he recognized the signs because when he was an apprentice doctor in Philadelphia 20 years earlier, the same thing happened. Like, there was a more minor outbreak of yellow fever. So he recognized the signs and he immediately went to the administration of Philadelphia and he said, "Hey, you guys need to put together some infrastructure. This is about to get real bad real fast." And they listened to him because he was pretty well respected.
Oh, good. That's nice. Yeah. You don't often hear that kind of story.
Okay, so here's a fun fact. Did you know that Pennsylvania Hospital, one of the most prominent hospitals in the New World at the time, didn't take patients who had infectious diseases?
Why?
To keep them away because, from other people?
Yeah, because someone could get sick.
That's so weird.
So, like, what did the people with infectious diseases do?
Well, Dr. Rush helped institute a sick house. So there's this place called Bush Hill that belonged to a man named William Hamilton, no relation to our favorite. not that I know, anyway. William Hamilton was out in England for a few months. So he gave them permission to use his house and grounds for patients who had the yellow fever. They kept them in the outbuildings. Now, why wouldn't they put them in the house, you ask?
I'm so glad. To get people not sick?
Well, that's the thing, is nobody was living in the house at the time, so it shouldn't have mattered. Except that Vice President John Adams was renting the house.
Wow.
Yeah. So, they're like, okay, John, you know, you've got this beautiful mansion, and I hope you really enjoy your stay here. Just don't go out to the shed.
People dying back there.
Just stay out of the stables. It's fine. Yeah, wow. It's great. Enjoy your stay at Bush Hill.
We hope you'll come back.
Yeah.
We hope you'll be able.
You can check out, but you can never leave.
I don't know if John Adams stayed for long. That was not specified in my sources.
Okay.
But, yeah, he was there running the house. Okay. All right. So let's talk about the signs of the day.
Okay.
It wasn't great.
Oh. Okay.
They're just post-Renaissance. Nobody's discovered germs yet. Doctors still think that washing your hands is a waste of time.
Wow.
It wasn't great. However, Dr. Rush, I think he did the best he could with the information given, more or less. With a healthy dose of, I'm the greatest doctor ever, and there's no way I can do wrong. So most people at the time were blaming the outbreak on a bunch of recent immigrants from San Domingue. All of these escaped slaves had come from St. Domingue. All of them, you know, all of them were black, and so people are like, oh, you know, they brought up the yellow fever from St. Domingue. And so there was a lot of backlash against the African community in Philadelphia. It was not a good scene. Unlike everyone else, though, Dr. Rush did not blame these immigrants. He said that it was probably some bad coffee that was left by the docks and set to fester and go rotten. And some people had eaten that, and that's how the plague had spread. Both of them were wrong. It was the mosquitoes.
Oh, I was about to say, I thought you said it was mosquitoes, Hannah.
It was definitely mosquitoes.
Okay.
He blamed the bad coffee.
Can you even get it from coffee? Like,
no, you can't. Okay. Not unless there's a mosquito in it and you eat the mosquito.
Oh, ew. Wow, okay.
based on that idea that it was a matter of filth, he instituted a lot of preventative measures, like exploding gunpowder in the streets to increase the amount of oxygen.
I'm sorry?
Really?
I don't think that's how oxygen works either.
No, it's not. In fact, explosions consume oxygen.
Yeah.
But he didn't know that at the time.
What? So apparently Philadelphia had not taken up any form of mining at this point.
Yeah, what did he think was happening?
Well, he thought that explosions produced oxygen. You know.
No.
As you do.
Like, I am not a scientist, but no.
Listen, I don't know the reasoning. It's just what he thought.
Okay. This guy has how many degrees?
2.
Okay.
And he can say oxygen in French.
Okay, so he also advocated the use of camphor and vinegar in smelling salts and handkerchiefs, because smelling the sick meant that you were breathing in the sick, right?
That's
definitely how that works. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I mean, if it was bacterial, maybe that would make sense.
But camphor and vinegar are not antibacterial.
No.
They just don't smell like sick.
No.
So, he also encouraged some actually good things to do, like try to stay rested and eat enough, and don't drink too much alcohol so you do not lower your immune resistance to this disease, which was actually really smart.
That is.
And, hey, here's an idea, stay away from sick people.
You'd think after the Black Plague we would have learned something about that, at least.
You'd think, but no.
Wow.
Also, he instituted a very interesting thing. So there was a paper published in 1942 by a doctor in Charleston that said about an outbreak of yellow fever there. Mm-hmm. This doctor noticed that the black people in Charleston, they were dying at a lower rate than the white people were. So he posited that they might have some natural immune resistance. Dr. Rush sent out a plea to the African community in Philadelphia, saying, please, you know, if you have this natural immunity, you might be able to help us save people, more people from this disease, that kind of thing. There was actually a huge outpouring of support from the African community. Black nurses, orderlies, and doctors came in to help.
That's awesome.
Unfortunately, he was wrong.
Oh,
he was wrong.
Did he get them all sick?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Unfortunately, black people, because there were so many helping, died at a rate 2 or 3 times higher than white people during this outbreak.
Wow.
Yeah, it looks, we think what happened, and, you know, we can't know this for sure because all the bodies are done rotted away at this point. You can't exactly do an autopsy, but we think that what happened with the 1942 paper is that most of the slaves in Charleston were first generation slaves. Like, they'd been taken directly from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Philadelphia, you had second and third generation people from, like, of African descent rather than from Africa themselves. So in Africa, you might get exposed to a much smaller or less severe virus version of the yellow fever virus. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of inoculated. Whereas here, there was not, they were not. Because again, there's not a natural immune thing that keeps you from getting yellow fever.
Yeah.
It's the mosquitoes.
Right.
Yeah, so that was unfortunate, but the African community in Philadelphia, you know, they backed up Dr. Rush and a lot of his scientific findings, despite the fact some of them were wrong. So Dr. Rush thought that the best way to treat yellow fever would be purging and bloodletting.
No.
That always ends well.
Wrong.
Yeah. It was a really common practice for fevers, which was falling out of fashion, but apparently not falling out of fashion enough. So he actually, like, had these huge classes of people that he would teach how to purge and bloodlet because he thought it worked so well. He claimed that he saved 99 out of 100 people if he got to them in time with purging and bloodletting.
Oh my gosh.
That's not true. That's not true.
Wow.
Eventually, he fell sick from yellow fever, too. He lost 3 apprentices and his sister to yellow fever because of this. He did not die, but it was not good. However, it should be pointed out that he stayed. Like, people were fleeing Philadelphia en masse. They estimate that 20% of the population of Philadelphia was sick. And of that, about half died.
Wow.
It was a terrifying time. It lasted for months. But he stayed.
That's good of him.
While he was doing these studies on how to best purge and bloodlet people, he discovered that mercury made a really great laxative, especially when combined with, you know, this poisonous plant from Mexico. It's I don't remember what the plant is called, but it's related to morning glories. So you grind that up with some mercury and put it in a pill, and bam, you've got the best dang laxative that you've ever seen.
Wow.
And you know,
yeah, not doing that.
It did work. Just, it, maybe it's just, it was also made of mercury and poison.
Yeah.
He called these laxatives Dr. Rush's bilious pills.
Wow.
Although, the common term for them, are you ready for this? The common term for them was thunderclappers.
Oh, God.
Oh, that's terrible.
Oh, that's wow. Great.
Yeah. They were actually a really popular laxative, you know. The people liked them, you know, thought they worked. That's they were so funny. Popular, in fact. Okay, so when Thomas Jefferson was president, he hired Dr. Rush as the official doctor for the Lewis and Clark expedition. He didn't go on the expedition, but he did set them up and give them all the medical supplies they would need. In a stunning move of targeted advertising, he included in their medical supplies 50 dozen thunderclappers.
That's so many.
Dozen.
That's a lot.
That's so many. Oh my gosh, it's so many.
I wonder if they used them.
Oh, they did. Okay, so what with their diet being mostly meat and eating weird other food and having bad water, someone was always kind of sick and someone always pretty much needed a laxative.
Right.
So they used these pills so often on the trail that archaeologists have been able to detect mercury and track
what?
Lewis and Clark all the way to the Pacific Ocean.
What?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious.
I know.
That's so
wow,
crazy.
They left a trail of
they
still traceable chemicals.
Yeah, that's, of mercury.
That's also slightly terrifying, but
that's a lot of mercury.
So much mercury.
It's so much. Anyway, that's my favorite fact about Benjamin Rush, is this is his legacy. A poop trail to the
Please write a book with that title.
Well.
Poop trail to the Pacific.
Yes.
At least he succeeded in getting back to nature somehow.
Oh, Lord. He went back to the woods.
Okay, so some other things about him that I thought were interesting. Not nearly so interesting as Poop Trail of the Pacific, but he was an abolitionist. He wrote papers arguing that people of African descent are not morally or physically or intellectually inferior to people of European descent in any way.
Yeah. Wow.
Which was an uncommon viewpoint at the time, let us say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
He also was a member of the Pennsylvania Abolitionist Society, although, again, with the hypocrisy, I should note that when he joined, he was the owner of a human being named William Grubber.
Ew. Did he free William Grubber?
The sources I looked at did not say, but there was the implication that, yes, he freed William Grubber at some point during his life.
That's good.
Which, you know, is a patch on all old George Washington, who freed slaves after his death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just saying. Of course, we don't know this for sure. I'd love if someone could tell me for certain about this. But yeah, no, the sources I have didn't specify.
What religion was he, do you know?
He was Presbyterian.
Okay, I was going to say, some of that sounds very Quaker, but...
Yeah, I thought so too, but he was in fact Presbyterian. He was, he argued strongly for the need to educate every American youth in Christianity. He even once wrote a letter to Congress saying that they should pay for every American family to have a Bible. on their own dime.
Wow.
On, like, taxpayer dime.
Interesting.
That would go down so well today.
Yeah, really. Okay, so he's also called the father of American psychiatry. And guess what? He wrote the first American textbook on that, too.
What wow. was it called?
I don't remember.
Something really long and boring?
Textbook something like on psychiatry.
Observations on illnesses of the mind or something like that.
Okay.
So, slightly better than a syllabus on lectures. So, he's actually made a lot of steps in psychiatry. Like, he's... Okay, so, he thought wrongly that mental illnesses were caused by, like, lack of blood circulation to the brain or overstimulation of the senses. So he did things like stick people on spinny centrifugal things to get all that good blood up to their brains.
Oh dear.
Wow, okay. Did it work?
No. No, it did not.
Didn't think so.
Brains don't work like that.
That is not how brains work. Or he would strap people to chairs in dark, quiet rooms called the tranquilizer chairs to deprive their senses of...
That's not...
sensation. I know. Yeah. Oh, I forgot to mention, he also treated people with mercury. He loved that mercury.
Where loved was he getting all the mercury?
It's in stuff. I mean, it's a byproduct of mining operations, so.
Okay.
Yeah, so he, you know, why is he called the father of American psychiatry if he did crap like this? Well, he also did other crap that was good. Which is, he argued for more humane conditions in asylums, which was a big deal. You know, obviously, places like Bedlam, you had people chained up because, you know, they were bipolar or whatever. And, you know, he argued that, hey, maybe we should not do that. And he did that, yeah, he put his patients in hospital settings rather than, you know, dungeons. And a few of them, like, recovered just from that. Shockingly.
Wow.
Amazing what happens when you treat someone like a human being.
Yeah.
He also suggested occupational therapy. He was one of the first proponents of occupational therapy. And, you know, the way that he worded it was kind of dumb. It was like, you know, why don't we let the men whittle something out of wood or dig around in a garden or let the women scrub something? It does wonders for their spirits. But the thing is that he wasn't wrong. You know, if you give people work to do, it often helps them recover more quickly.
Yeah.
He was one of the first people to describe savant syndrome. He wrote a paper describing a man who was a lightning calculator.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah, and he was one of the first people to suggest alcoholism as a disease, like treat it as a disease rather than a moral failing.
Interesting.
Really?
Yeah. So, very, you know, strange treatments. But otherwise very advanced thinking for the time.
I mean, I was going to say it's interesting that he referred to them as illnesses of the mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Instead of just, these people are nuts.
Yeah.
Like, they actually have a disease, and obviously spinning them in circles isn't going to cure it, but at least he was trying to look at it medically.
All, some of his things, you know, there are obvious places where we're like, you know, this, maybe treating with mercury, people with mercury is not a good idea. Especially people who already have, like, some kind of mental illness. Mercury only makes that worse, by the way. But, like you said, he was one of the first people to look at this medically, so, yeah, it was a big deal. He died of typhoid fever, April 19th, 1813, but he had a very interesting and eventful life, you know, and, you know, I'm interested in science, of course, and history, so watching the things that he did with the time he had was really interesting to me, so, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That is cool.
So that's my colloquium.
Yay.
Nice. Thank you, Hannah. I like that he's kind of the... got a good stuff, a lot of bad stuff. Because that's, you know, how people are.
Yep. Yeah. Shockingly, he was a human being.
What?
Okay. Should we move on to post-grad problems?
Yes. I would like that. So post-grad problems, some of these, obviously we're going to try to, I think most of our post-grad problems we're going to try to make kind of applicable to most post-grads, if not all, but some of mine are going to be a bit more expat problems, as I am someone who, I've lived in the States my whole life and then moved to the UK to go to grad school. This one is not so much an expat problem, which are normally like, I'm not used to this, it's so new. This one is more an expat who is going home soon problem.
Okay.
So I'm moving home back to Texas this summer, and there's a few things that I'm already just like, I'm gonna miss this so much. And, like, there's some, a lot of it's local stuff, like the parks. I really enjoy the parks around Oxford. I'm gonna miss those. But a few are more cultural, and one of them is pubs.
Okay. So you're going to have to explain the difference between a pub and a bar.
Yes, okay. Because, like,
I think of a pub as the same place as, you know, my friends go to drink and dance and whatever.
No.
Like, not quite a club. Maybe that, classier than a club.
Those are different. So I haven't studied the difference. I can't, and people will probably correct me on both sides. But, like, I think there is definitely a difference between pubs and bars and things like that. Like, pubs have bars in them, but they're different. Okay, so here, we'll just do a little definition thing. Does a bar serves alcohol? Yes. Does a bar usually serve food, like meals?
I mean, not good food.
Not actual good food.
So a pub definitely would serve food. Usually, like, you know, traditional British food, traditional Irish food, that kind of thing. But then it's not the same as, like, a restaurant. Like, there might be waitstaff that bring food out to you, but they're not gonna, like, come check on you. So, like, you get to a pub, you pick any table that's got enough room for you and your crew, you all go up to the bar, order food, drink, they give you the drink, you go sit down, and a little bit later someone might bring out your food or something like that. But right. It's really, like, so that's how it functions. But it's really just the atmosphere of pubs that I'm just, here's what it is. I said last time that all the post-grad problems we're going to do, or at least all the ones that I can think of, are really community problems. So here, if I wanted to hang out with someone, a pub is the perfect place to do it. There's food, there's drink, it's a really relaxed atmosphere. I go every week, on Sundays, I go to an evening service at a church, and then me and my friends from church, we all go to this pub and just hang out and have dinner. It's great. And it's one of the only social things I have, like, really nailed down in my week. And so without that, I'm gonna go back to Texas and be like, I have to meet new people, and I do not know how to hang out with these people. Like, because the closest thing that Texas has is going to be either bars, which I'm just not a fan of. They don't have that same atmosphere. It is not a place you just go for dinner and to hang out, in my mind. Or coffee shops, which don't have food.
Yeah.
Then you have restaurants. Like, the only place you go out for a meal would be a restaurant that's kind of a fancier thing. And it's just not that same relaxed atmosphere. I don't know. Say I've met someone. It doesn't matter where we've met. Maybe it's work, maybe it's church, maybe it's in the park, I don't know. I have met a friend. I wanted to go meet them just to hang out. Where, as you people are in the States, where would you go meet this person?
I mean, a coffee shop, probably.
Coffee shop, probably.
Yeah. See, the thing about coffee shops is, one, I don't drink coffee. Two, American coffee shops serve mediocre tea at best.
That's true.
Like,
that's true.
Most of the chai tea lattes I've gotten in my life is because someone wanted to meet at a coffee shop and I don't drink coffee and I refuse to drink Lipton tea, so I end up just getting chai tea, which is great. Chai tea lattes are great. They're very sugary. I don't know. So that's the thing. Maybe it's just I need to drink coffee or something, but I don't drink coffee, and coffee shops are just, that's not what I want.
Coffee shops also are not, like, evening places.
No.
Like, you go to a coffee shop at night.
Yeah.
Like, when was the last time I hung out with my friends, like, at a restaurant in the evening?
It's
and
not
it
what
always
you
ends
do.
Up being a place like Waffle House or Denny's.
Yeah, okay. But that's
or,
not, like, ideal.
Or it's somewhere where you go for good food, but then you feel guilty for staying too long.
Yeah, so that's the other thing with pubs, is, like, you can just stay.
That's one thing I miss,
like,
when I was
like, you're never going to be asked, I'm sorry, can we use this table? You're never going to be asked that.
Yeah,
it's just a place to be.
I miss that from Lithuania, because we used to go to restaurants and you could sit there for 2 hours and you could not order for like 15, 20 minutes in, and then you could order your food, and then it takes them a while to cook it because they actually cook the food.
Right?
And then you sit there for another hour and a half and they don't care.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Because that's the same with pubs here in the UK. It's just you get in, like, no one pays attention. You just go sit wherever there's room. If there's not room, you might ask, like, hey, do you guys have another, like, are there more tables we're not seeing? Because a lot of the time these pubs are, like, several rooms connected, and you gotta be like, oh, there's another room in the back, we didn't see it. That kind of stuff. No, so yeah, you get up there, you order, you know, a burger and a beer, and they give you the beer, and then you go back, sit down, and eventually a burger will be there. And then when you're done, you can stay for as long as you want. Some pubs get in, like, live music. Not all of them do. The one I frequent most doesn't. It's just a place to hang out and be and chat until it's very late and things. And there's alcohol. It's good. It's not a dance floor. There are not people dancing. It's not a place where you go and, like, people, like, you don't go there to pick up people, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
People do not go, like, unlike bars, like, maybe I just don't have this experience, but it would be very odd for me if I went to a pub and talked to a stranger who was, like, hitting on me.
Yeah.
That's not to say they're not social and you don't talk to other people, but it's not, like, primarily for that, I would say.
Okay. I'm trying to think of places that I've been to like this, and the only place I can think of is, like, there's this pizza place in my town.
Okay.
And it's, like, I don't remember if they serve alcohol or not, but, like, yeah, it's more or less a fast food place that just has some picnic tables inside the building, and there's an arcade game, and, like...
Just one.
Is it Pac-Man?
No,
I feel like this is, like, one of those, it's gonna be a film where that one arcade game is actually, like, magic or something. Like, it's not been played in years, but the next person to play it, it'll be, like, Tron or something.
But yeah, like, that would be a place that I would go and not feel weird about staying a while, mm-hmm. or, like, yeah, just get a piece of pizza and a soda and, like, just stick around. Yeah. The only problem is that it's really small, and so there's limited seating.
Yeah.
So, like, I would personally feel bad if I came in and I was taking up a table that other people needed.
See, that's the thing, is with pubs, it's often the case. You might, like, the reason that we always end up at the same exact pub after we go to church, which, by the way, there are so many pubs in this city. Like, we have a huge pick. The reason we always go to the one we do is, one, they have good enough food. But two, there's usually room for, like, six of us to sit down. Whereas a lot of pubs, you walk in and you might spend a bit looking for a table. But even if there's a lot of people coming in, it's not the type of place where I would ever feel pressure to get up and leave. Even if, like, some people came in and looked around and couldn't find a table and then left. Well, one thing is there are so many pubs in this city. Like, they can walk half a block and there'll be, like, three they can choose from. One of the funniest things that's happened to me in Oxford, I was walking down the street and this guy just comes up and says, you know, do you know where I can find a pub? And I knew because at the time I knew there was a big rugby game on, so I knew what he was asking was, the game is starting in like 2 minutes, I need a place to watch it. But I just stopped and I was like, well, I was like, I almost was like, would you like me to list by distance or alphabetically or by which is best? Like, I was like, there was literally one, like, behind him. So I was like, well, there's that one. And then the next one. Well, if you turn left, we were at an intersection, right? So I was like, okay, so if you go right behind you, there's literally two. If you turn right on this street, there's another. If you turn left, there's like four. I can name them. If you want a really good one, you might go down a little bit this way. You know, it was like, please take the buffet of pubs. Like, if you want to walk even further, there's one up there. And yeah, but it was just like, do you know where a pub is? It's like, how many do you need? But yeah, I don't... Maybe it's just this city and the fact that we have a million of them. But I would never feel the need to get up and leave a pub because I was taking up room. Because it's like, that's what this place is for.
The one thing I found in Lithuania that I thought might make an inroad into the US that I haven't seen as much of is a time cafe.
Sorry, a what?
A time cafe.
A time cafe. I've seen these.
Welcome to the time cafe.
Yes.
Would you like to go in the past or the future?
But, yeah, so at least the one I went to, you go in and you can have all the tea or coffee you want. They have books, they have games, they have music. Board games, actual board games.
Yes.
And you just pay for the time.
Yes. There's one of those here that's a board game cafe, actually. So it's called Thirsty Meeples. and it's a cafe slash bar where, I mean, technically they do have sandwiches and they do have drinks, both hard, like, you can get wine or I get cider or whatever. You can get that kind of stuff, but what they mostly have is a huge selection of board games, like ones you've never heard of before. And you go in and you pay for the time, and then you can play any of the games, how many you want, like, just bring your own game if you want. I'm actually not sure how they feel about bringing your own game, but you can play any of their games. And for most of the games, they try to keep someone around who can teach you how to play it.
Oh, that's nice. That is real nice.
Yeah, so we've had a couple games.
The first hour of any given game board is, how do I play this game? Let's read all the directions.
Yeah, and like, some of the games they have are, like, very high strategy games. So, like, one of the times I've been in there, a friend was teaching me how to play the board game version of Civ 5, and when the person got it for us, they were like, sorry, do you know how to play this one? And we were like, yeah, and they're like, oh, good, because none of us do. Because they just, I mean, I'm sure someone who works there did, but no one who was on staff at the time did. But, yeah, it's a small little place, but it's nice.
I've played that game, it's awesome.
It's good, right?
It's so good.
Yeah, we usually just go in there to play Catan or whatever.
Yeah.
I wish there were more places like that, though.
I feel like that'd be so stressful to pay for time. I would always be thinking about the time.
No, because at least the one I was in, you paid afterwards. Like, they tallied it up afterwards.
Oh, that helps.
So it's not like you pay for 2 hours and then the buzzer hits and they throw you out the door.
Mine, every time I've been to this place, I've had an external time limit. Like, I'm sorry, I can only stay till 6 because I've got another meeting. So it's never been an issue in that regard. Okay. But these people, I think you do pay for time up front. But it's not like they're keeping watch on you. I really don't know.
Like, how much? Like,
$5? Are you going to make me go look it up?
Or $20. No, I mean, maybe. I'm very
something
curious
like
about
this. Something between like $5, $8 for like an hour or two. I don't remember.
Okay, that's not bad.
That's not bad at all.
But yeah, I need more better places to casually hang out with people, in which it is not the case that what we are doing is going to get dinner together, because somehow that seems way more stressful.
Yeah.
But it is the case that we can hang out, that there's stuff everyone likes, and also that we have the option of buying a meal if we do want food. I need places to just be with people more.
I have a suggestion for you.
Yes.
And that is to find your hipster local coffee joints. They're just hipster enough to have good tea. And sometimes they have good food, too. Like, I feel like here, and maybe it's just because Missoula is a very hipster town. I mean, if for Montana, anyway. we'll get into that later. Maybe it's just because it's a college town thing, but, like, here I can go to... I can think of 2 or 3 coffee shops where I can get, like, a solid meal as well as delicious coffee beverages, and where I could stay for a while. And
I don't know.
Like, I think that, I mean, if they exist here in Montana, they should be in Dallas, too.
I guess I'll look.
Dallas is a big city, and, like, so there's got to be something.
Yeah.
And if you look, I think you'll find it.
Americans. So, yes, that was my expat problem love letter to pubs. I will miss you when I'm gone.
Do we have something to suggest? What are we into this week?
So, I was lucky enough this week to do several things involving theater. And one of them... Do you guys know what National Theater Live is? Or Inti Live?
A little bit.
I think you guys do. Yeah, so...
I know enough.
This is my big recommendation and charge to everyone who is listening to this. Please go Google National Theater Live. So, the National Theater is... the National Theatre of Great Britain. They have several different places they perform in the UK. The biggest one is the National Theatre upon the Thames. But in any case, they do this really unique program where they go to a live showing of a theatre production and make an extremely high-quality recording of it. And I mean, like, dynamic recording. This isn't just someone set up a camera in the back of the theatre. It's a very well-done recording.
Middle school play.
You get a lot closer to, like, what's happening on stage, and there's lots of different angles. It's like a a film-level production, but of a live theater performance. And what they do is they first actively live-stream it to cinemas around the country, and then later do special encore showings. To be honest, I've seen a good handful of these now, not all of them, but there is not a single one that I would not go rewatch right now. If they said, tomorrow we're doing a showing, I'd be like, I am there. I will cancel other things to go watch this. If you've heard at all about, let's see, Benedict Cumberbatch did Hamlet, they streamed that. Kenneth Branagh did Macbeth. Tom Hiddleston did Coriolanus. Those are just the big name ones. Frankenstein?
Frankenstein, who had both of the men currently playing Sherlock Holmes on television.
Yes, Sherlock from Sherlock and Sherlock from Elementary, both
which
played
is fantastic.
In a theatrical version of Frankenstein.
Some very, like, upsetting content at some point. Yeah. Like, don't be like the couple sitting behind me and bring your kids.
Frankenstein.
It was not good.
So the most recent play that they've done is Bernard Shaw's Saint Joan. But the next one they're doing, I know they're doing Twelfth Night soon, which should be really fun. So, I don't know when it is you're watching, listening to this. But whenever it is, whatever their productions are, they're gonna be good. Please go look up National Theatre Live. I would just really like to support those people. I mean, it's not like they need a lot of support and donations and stuff. They're the National Theatre and they're amazing. But if more and more and more people go, every time I want to book tickets early and I want to get there early, and then I show up and there's like 7 people in the theatre with me. And I'm so disappointed because they're some of the best performances I've ever seen, some of the best stuff I've ever seen on the big screen.
So that about wraps it up for us. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you again in a couple of weeks. Until then, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
I'm Rissa.
And until next time, learn something worth knowing.